Will the clerk call the roll?
Bennett?
Here.
Bradley?
Here.
Brown? Buchholz?
Here.
Carpenter?
Here.
Chatterton?
Here.
Cotton?
Here.
Cooper?
Here.
Dankworth?
Here.
Duncan?
Here.
Eliason?
Here.
Freeman?
Here.
Gardner?
Here.
Greening?
Here.
Guy?
Here.
Haugen? Hayes? Kelly? Bethine? McKinnon? Malone? Meekins? Miles? Nackack? Osie? Osterback? Parr? Phillips? Rode? Rudd? Schaefer? Smith? Snyder? Specking? Swanson? Urien? Akers? Mr. Speaker?
Here.
38 present, 1 absent, 1 vacancy.
Please stand for a prayer by Reverend Michael Miles of Ontario, Oregon.
Let us pray. Blessed are you and praised, Heavenly Father, for your great work in creation, for the abundance with which you have blessed this land of Alaska. Blessed are you and praised, Heavenly Father, for sending us your Son, Jesus Christ, to redeem us by his death on the cross, and his rising to new life. Give us the wisdom to serve you faithfully, to do what is best for the common good of your people here in Alaska, so that one day they may all come to eternal life. Blessed are you and praised, Heavenly Father, with your Son, Jesus Christ, in the unity of the Holy Spirit, now and always, and forever and ever.
Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Bradley.
Move and ask unanimous consent that we spread the prayer on the journal.
Without objection, the prayer will be spread on the journal. I might mention in passing that it's not purely coincidence that Father Miles shares the same name with one of our colleagues. Father Miles is Representative Miles' brother. Clerk, please certify the roll, or the journal.
There is a correction to the first day's journal. On page 3, paragraph 2, change Alaska Supreme Court to read Alaska Superior Court. With this correction, I certify as to the correctness of the journal for the first day.
Representative Gardner.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that we certify as corrected by the clerk of the House, Journal of January 10th.
Representative Gardner moves and asks unanimous consent that the journal be accepted as corrected by the chief clerk. Is there objection? Hearing none, the journal is certified. We're down to introduction of guests. If there are no introduction of guests at this time, Representative Urien.
Mr. Speaker, pro tem, I'd like to take this opportunity to advise you and the members of the majority party that those of us in the minority are organized and ready to work. And in the minority party, Mr. Speaker, there are 15 of us. We're dedicated people who came here to work for the betterment of the future of the state. We've set aside our personal wishes for the state interests. Mr. Speaker, I hope that you and members of your party will take heed and follow suit and set aside your desires for personal betterment and look toward the state of Alaska. And maybe we can get on and get organized here. We're getting tired of sitting around.
Representative Gardner.
I guess this is time when you say a word to the wise is sufficient. I don't know if we're wise yet. But, before we call a recess, I'd like to announce a Democratic luncheon today at noon in the Capitol Room of the Baranoff Hall. It says all Democratic legislators are invited as guests. I suspect other legislators are too. I'd like to call for a recess for purposes of caucuses to call the chair.
Without objection, Representative Haugen. Let there be light. It's not wired today. Well, Representative Haugen, until we get organized and know who will be in this seat permanently, that's the big problem. It's a problem we hope to solve, President.
I can't understand that the conditional, the assembly of parking folks, it looks exactly like
Representative Hogan, your remarks are not out of line at this point in time. There is no motion before the House. Those remarks would properly come before us, perhaps under special orders, and we'll pursue it further if there's a motion before the House. Right now, the motion before the House, unless there's objection, is to recess for purposes of party caucus. If I hear no objection, we're in recess to the call of the chair. Under the joint rules of the legislature, the president of the Senate presides at all joint meetings. It's my pleasure at this time to turn the gavel over to Senator Rader.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker Pro Tem. Joint session will come to order. Senator Coletta.
Yes, Mr. President.
Is there any objection? So ordered. Representative Gardner. Is there any objection? So ordered. I hereby appoint Representative Specking and Senator Pat Rohde to escort the governor to the chambers. Legislature and ladies and gentlemen of the state of Alaska, I've served with Governor Hammond in the House of Representatives. I've served with him in the state Senate, and it's a great pleasure for me today to turn over to him the rostrum at this time to address the people of the state of Alaska and this joint session.
This is the only time we meet together to review important statewide issues, to reflect on where we've been, to examine where we are, and to speculate on where we hope to go. Growth and change within Alaska compel growth and change within state government if we would be masters of our future. However, the growth I speak of relates not at all to size of budgets or new statutes. Rather, the need to grow into a government big enough to realize it does not have all the answers, and to search them out by asking questions of the people. Growth of government, as well, should be toward decency and openness, toward wiser management of all our resources, and toward a reasoned, more realistic attack on human problems, which we will have with us always. And so far as seeking answers is concerned, if we are to influence decisions on D2 lands, gas pipeline routings, oil pricing, on OCS development, we must subordinate special interests to the public interest. Else those decisions will be made in outside corporate boardrooms or committees devoid of meaningful Alaskan influence. To determine what truly is that public interest, we must take time to listen, not waste time trying to outshout one another. Only by listening and then accommodating as best we can the concerns of most Alaskans can we present in those arenas beyond our borders persuasive arguments which may prevail. Let's amplify those points we have in common while muting those we have in conflict. For 2 years, I have listened to Alaskans and have heard much more harmony than discord. Most really aspire to the same objective, the opportunity to earn a decent living at a stimulating job within a quality social and physical environment. We but disagree on how that can be accomplished. To help reconcile these disagreements, government should factually outline alternatives for the public's consideration and then listen carefully. not simply tell the protesting public how the disagreement is to be resolved. I have confidence an informed majority most often picks the wisest course. Unfortunately, citizen confidence in government has seldom been at lower ebb, and who can blame them? Though the goal of all the governed, as well as those, or most of those who govern, is a model government of decency and fairness, history teaches us that goal sometimes obscures in the shadow of favoritism, personal ambition, misplaced loyalties, or justifying means to ends. But it doesn't have to be that way. To preclude it, we must assure that all receive open, fair, and equal treatment. Individuals who deal with the state should get the same treatment accorded powerful corporations, local governments, or unions, and vice versa. Unfortunately, such has not always been the case. Recently, the state has gone to court to undo special interest treatment previously accorded. While I take little pleasure in pursuing actions which inevitably incur accusations of witch hunting or politics, favoritism displeases me still more. Court rulings on the Teamsters Mall and the OHM farming project clearly demonstrate that justice warranted our actions, no matter what motivation was presumed or the political points lost in the process. As government should treat all equally, so should it be equally available to all. Alaskans must be assured their voices will be heard by those of us in public office. Lest we forget, we are the public servants and not their lords and masters. Thus, I have stressed such programs to the Alaskan Public Forum, in which Alaskan voices can be heard with more clarity and volume by all branches. To assure the public interest will continue to be paramount when this administration leaves, the public must be conditioned to expect to play a part in the decision-making process. Thus, I hope the Alaska Public Forum will be preserved beyond our time as a lobby in the people's interest. Through the forum, Alaskans should be provided facts so that they can then inform us as to where and how they wish. Certainly, as one both hired and privileged to lead the state, I look for an informed public to point to paths along which they would be led. It's not right for me alone, for example, to determine the whole road's fate. Rather, I should apprise the public of all the facts, then, regardless whether my motives dictate it should be plowed up or paved over, I should be prepared to follow the dictates of an informed public, even if they be at odds with mine. Unless such compel compromise of personal moral judgment or integrity. Thus, though I believe the motivations of most who favored moving the Capitol could be met by periodically moving the legislature and my office, I've received my marching orders from the people and will do my best to assure they are obeyed with minimal possible expense, delay, or trauma. Ideally, the Capitol move, D2 lands, and pipeline route should have been debated a public forum. However, when I contrast the open gas pipeline route debate to the closed and biased non-debate attending the oil pipeline issue, I'm heartened, for we've come a long, long way. Was it only 6 short years ago that it was impermissible to suggest the oil pipeline might cost more than $900 million, to express suspicion that some Alaskan oil might be headed to Japan, that oil tankers posed a far greater hazard than piping oil, and that if another 1,700 miles of pipeline were required to bring oil to Midwestern markets, our presumed revenues might be substantially diminished. Even to suggest investigation of those matters at that time incurred incredible abuse. If we can keep the public forum process, it's unlikely we will ever again sweep aside legitimate concerns or shackle those who do not choose march in lockstep with ourselves. Good government is open government with unstrictured two-way communications. Not only must it listen, but the people must be told what their government is doing and the reasons why it is doing it. Another example of adherence to this premise was the way we handled the Kachemak Bay issue. After examining the evidence, I concluded the state had issued leases improperly without sufficient public process. Thus, I introduced a bill to authorize repurchase in an effort to force the type of discussion over possible resource conflicts that should have occurred before lease constituents. The legislature debated that question and concluded leasing had been a mistake and that the administration should be authorized to repurchase. Subsequently, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that the leases were in fact not issued properly. We have negotiated for repurchase at the amount paid the state plus interest and minimal other costs. We will submit a supplemental appropriation now for about one half the total amount. The rest will be credited against monies already due the state. I talked about the kind of government Alaskans want, but what is it that they want their government to do? Certainly all agree that the people's money spent for governmental operations should be managed carefully. Unfortunately, in the past, government has not always managed people's money carefully. In my budget message, I'll discuss past unsound fiscal practices and propose remedial action. Suffice now to say that all else is overshadowed by this consideration. We must stem the tide of unhealthy government expansion by limiting its growth to that which people want enough to pay for as they go. Should we instead continue using inappropriate, non-renewable resource revenues for expanding government, red ink will surely drown our children. To help stem that tide, let's draw on lessons from the past, all 900 million. Last year, Alaskans placed one finger in the dike when they overwhelmingly endorsed a constitutional amendment permitting creation of a permanent fund savings account. Now, at least some non-renewable resource revenues can be shielded from those who would use them to expand ongoing governmental programs. I propose initially that 50% of those resource revenues be placed in this, the People's Bank, and urge you to increase that percentage as soon as possible. Management of the fund and use of income from it are two major issues. Since Alaskans do not want all fund earnings to be used simply to expand state government, I propose we return a portion of those earnings directly to Alaskans. We are investing public resource monies, and the public should see a direct return on that investment. To assure they do, I'm advocating the ultimate and grassroots revenue sharing. Rather than filtering all shared revenues through bureaucratic blankets, let the citizens determine how at least a portion of their wealth is spent. How better to boost citizen confidence in government than to give them more control of it? My proposal does exactly that. Rather than permitting government to spend all public monies earned through exploitation of the public resources for what government thinks best, let's grant shares to Alaskans and let them determine what services they want enough to permit government to recoup those shares in taxes. Nothing could do more to curb excessive growth of government. As another step toward paying as we go for services, I would propose some tax measures which, if passed, would reduce the dangers of further expanding government from inappropriate revenues. These taxes could, however, be more than offset by dividends accruing to most Alaskans under my citizens' shared revenue proposal. I first made a similar proposal when the $900 million was acquired. It's interesting to speculate as to whether most Alaskans believe they received more value from how those monies were expended than they would have if we'd simply invested that $900 million and sent annual dividend checks from its earnings to all, quote, stockholders in what I termed Alaska Inc. As another step toward curbing government expense, 2 years ago, we initiated a comprehensive efficiency study and have already implemented many recommendations. I will submit legislation to accomplish more. One will be an executive order creating a Department of Transportation. The order will permit most of the study's recommendations to be accomplished. However, it would do so under one agency instead of two, as I proposed last year. While the two-department approach yet appears to have some advantages, interim discussions with conservation groups, industry, legislators, and state employees evidence more support for the single-agency approach. Thus, I have modified the order in accordance with my commitment to both listen and respond to the public wishes. If such can be done without doing violence to my basic precepts. Efficiency in government demands the electorate know true governmental costs. Alaskans are frequently required to vote in ignorance on true costs in bond elections. They are told initial anticipated costs, but not told the life costs of maintenance and operation. They should be. see they are, I'll introduce legislation requiring bond proposition to provide estimates of total project costs. Such life cycle costing candor is long overdue. Its absence has led to substantial, subtle increased costs not anticipated by voters. Another example of hidden costs and false economy emerged from the rubble of our roads. Like you, I've been appalled at how highways such as Egan Drive and Tudor Road crumbled before our very eyes, or perhaps more appropriately, beneath our bucket seats. Upon investigation, I learned construction standards had been lowered in order to lay more miles of road for the same amount of money. Reversing once more the emphasis from quantity to quality, I insisted that highway construction standards be elevated, and our new road should no longer require costly reconstruction. Just as two quantitative costs should be exposed, so should the qualitative value of governmental services. Thus, I will introduce a sunset law requiring agencies to justify their continued existence. Alaska's future depends greatly on natural resource development decisions, which, unfortunately, will be made by others. We can but try to influence those decisions, such as we have done through pressuring the federal government to alter their crash schedule for exploitation of Alaska's outer continental shelf. Last week, I briefed the new Interior Secretary designee on our remaining concerns and believe they will be accommodated. Another such outside decision we hope to influence relates to Prudhoe Natural Gas. Accordingly, I will bring before the legislature a resolution to approve the sale of surplus royalty gas under the best possible contract I believe could be negotiated. We welcome scrutiny of that contract. The public interest, of course, demands it. Hopefully, you will conclude that the contract is sound and both promotes and protects Alaska's interest insofar as possible. Another major decision concerns appropriate taxation. Department of Revenue, in cooperation with the legislature's Legislative Council's Interim Committee, has studied Alaska's oil and gas tax structure. They advise there may be major deficiencies which should be corrected. The tax study should be released shortly, and after it has been reviewed by the legislature, industry, and the public, I hope we will together take appropriate action. Similarly, we have studied oil and gas leasing policies. We'll be proposing legislation which complements our tax proposal. While we hope to benefit economically from development of our oil and gas, we must ensure, as best we can, we do not befoul our environmental process. Seven recent oil tanker incidents remind us of hazards confronting us when more oil starts to flow. To minimize those hazards, last session legislation passed imposing strict tanker standards. Subsequently, a federal court declared similar legislation unconstitutional. We'll defend Alaska's law, but it may not withstand legal challenge. Accordingly, we must make certain pollution standards are stringent and legally impeccable so as to make pollution economically unprofitable. Present law limits civil liability for oil spills to $100,000 plus damages the state can prove. Proving damages, of course, is extremely difficult. Therefore, I will submit legislation fixing civil fines of not less than $5 nor more than $50 per gallon for oil discharged into the state waters. There will be no upper limit on total liability. At the same time, we continue to press industry, Congress, and the Coast Guard for improved tanker standards and navigational aids to minimize hazards to Alaskan waters. Oil and gas are, of course, non-renewable resources, which someday will be gone. Hopefully, remaining in their wake will be healthy, renewable resources. With Alaska's rapid growth, some of these resources have come under devastating pressure. We must make both increased sacrifice and effort if we are to retain them for the future. While this year's catch of over 40 million salmon was far above that in the last 4 years, some stocks are in deep trouble. Hopefully, projects funded by the Fishery Rehabilitation Fund will go a long way toward improving our salmon runs. Further on the bright side, shellfish production increased healthily in 1976. An extended jurisdiction to 200 miles gives us real hope of curtailing foreign encroachment into American fish stocks. The timber situation has also improved slightly. Federal court decisions impacting logging prompted Congress to pass the Forest Management Act, requiring compromise and those who sought more strict control. This should help dissipate the cloud of litigation under which industry has tried to operate for years. A similar spirit of compromise was refreshingly evident, at least here in Alaska. After years of combat, competing users of the Tongass National Forest were at last working together on a plan of utilization more acceptable to all. This administration encouraged those discussions and was berated for it by those who, unfortunately, had to learn the hard way from Morris Udall. The proposed compromise was the epitome of reason from their point of view compared to what they'll likely get. Hopefully, that lesson will stick with us as discussions regarding D2 lands progress. Land, of course, is a prime resource. Till recently, state selections have been forestalled while the Settlement Act was hammered out and native land selections made. We now intend to move ahead and determine, with the public's help, what public domain and national forest lands we should select. As we select lands, we should also plan wisely for their use. The Cook Inlet land grant is the state's unprecedented first attempt to join with native corporations and the federal government in a cooperative land planning process. Our work with local communities planning for OCS development is another. The evolution of the D2 issue will, I believe, further enhance the cooperative land use planning concept, since it may be the only viable alternative which provides the state with any input whatsoever on management of federal lands within Alaska. Proper means of satisfying the land needs and desires of Alaskans yet remain an issue. With about 111 acres per capita already in private ownership, there may actually be no land shortage, but rather a price shortage, since many cannot afford to buy these lands, or they are simply not for sale. Thus, I will submit a bill to make residential home sites available first to residents incapable of securing land on which to build a home. Any disposal system raises one prime question. To what extent should we subsidize individuals by providing them with public lands at less than market value, when those land values belong to all the people? Legislation submitted last year failed to reconcile this question. This year, I'll submit a bill which is more limited, can be reasonably administered, and is designed to test success before permitting its expansion. The third basic goal of government is to provide reasonable human services designed to improve the lot of both society and the individual. The key word is reasonable. Here, small gains are deemed, unreasonably perhaps, major triumphs, for we're dealing with human behavior, often not even understood. Unfortunately, thorny social problems cannot easily be smothered. Try drowning them in dollars and they bob gasping to the surface, demanding greater aid. Take crime. Everyone's concerned about it. Yet efforts to curb criminal behavior are noteworthy only for their spectacular shortcomings. It's time to admit that fact and do what we can do with crime rather than simply agonize over that we cannot do. One thing we did was eliminate plea bargaining, and I believed it helped. For example, recently a judge himself tried to reduce a charge from first-degree murder to manslaughter in return for a guilty plea. The Supreme Court, however, ruled the judge could not reduce the charge if the DA refused to do so. The case was retried and resulted in a conviction for first-degree murder. That's one bad bargain we didn't make. There have been many more. Criminal justice in this state should be dispensed fairly, openly, and firmly in full measure. It should not be distorted or diluted through deals. Last year, our determinate sentencing bill passed one house and died. Present a new version which recognizes that while rehabilitation should be one purpose of criminal sentencing, it should not be the only purpose. Criminal behavior should result in at least some punishment. Thus, our proposal will fix jail terms for repeat felony offenders, not leave them to the whim of the parole board. Our jail situation is deplorable and growing worse. Accordingly, last year, the Division of Corrections underwent intensive scrutiny and major renovations were undertaken. But even these steps were far from adequate. We must have more secure facilities to house prisoners, for we simply have run out of room. Alaska Alaskans recently rejected a bond issue, which included some minor new jail facilities. And I believe they did so because the bond issue included construction of court and other facilities which voters did not favor at this time. Therefore, a general fund appropriation will be necessary to make jails more secure. Moreover, the federal prison system appears about to disgorge upon us some 63 hardcore felons, contending they can no longer be housed outside. Either we make room for them in jail, or they'll be back among us and out on the street. It's as simple and serious as that. We spend far more time discussing what to do about criminals than dealing with the cause of crime. Every study shows that alcohol causes much of it. We all know it. It's time we did something about it. Therefore, I'm proposing that we wage war on alcohol abuse. As our opening gun, let's at least require alcohol to pay a greater portion of costs directly attributable to it. Records indicate there's a minimal $10 million shortfall between governmental costs attributable to alcohol abuse and revenues derived from alcohol. Such a shortfall obligates a subsidy from monies which must come from other sources and could go for other programs. Many persons at Alaska Public Forums have urged that we eliminate that subsidy by increasing the tax on alcohol, which has not been increased since 1961. Accordingly, I'll submit legislation to increase revenues, without which we cannot hope to launch a tax on alcohol abuse, prevention, treatment, or rehabilitation. Employment is another area in which we sought realistic goals and made some progress toward them. Prior to this administration, the resident hire law was unenforced in fear that it might topple in the courts. Rather than continue to curry just another paper tiger, we decided to test its teeth. So far, the courts have upheld our actions, and through them, an unprecedented number of Alaskans received employment preference. We've made some great advances on yet another labor front. In the last 2 years, Alaska has moved from the worst job safety rating to the best in Region 10. Much remains to be done to meet our constitutional mandate to fund education fully and equitably. Costs of education are not shared appropriately. Communities with low property tax values are disadvantaged, and inequities remain in both financing and allocation of school facilities. However, with creation of REAAs, increased foundation funding, and the resolution of the so-called Hooch case, through passage of the $59 million school bond issue, we are closer to our goal. To move even closer, I'll submit a bill to aid needed municipal school construction, which sets forth need criteria and would provide full 50% front-end funding rather than dribbling such aid out over the debt service period. Thus, though the initial state costs might be greater, accumulated costs to both state and municipality would be far less due to interest savings. Medical malpractice remains a major problem. Last year, I initiated the public process which proposed resolution. You debated, amended, and in part adopted that proposal. One feature many doctors now find repugnant is mandatory participation. Yet without it, administrators of the plan believe it cannot work. The question is this: is the cure prescribed worse than the disease? Hopefully, new remedies you might concoct will treat the basic ill and not just a single symptom. I will introduce measures to crack down on welfare fraud, improve child support enforcement, permit local areas to assume control of health services. You'll note few new programs. We already have programs enough. It's dollars which are in too short supply. Moreover, what is needed is the imagination and ability to make existing programs work, or the fortitude to wipe them out before we obscure the fact that they are not working under yet another program. With this in mind, the Department of Health and Social Services is undergoing a massive examination. For the first time, it has set its basic goals explicitly: prevention, unification, and decentralization. It is digging at the very foundation of its structure to eliminate or remedy those programs which do not advance those goals, while bolstering those which do. The true state of the state, of course, is best reflected in people's attitudes and not in amplitude of program. Things are what we think they are, not what politicians tell us. Take the pipeline. Optimists look upon its completion as the end of the beginning, while doomsayers decry it as the beginning of the end. The truth, of course, is somewhere in between. However, neither brave pronouncements which defy reality, nor charges that the sky is falling, will help find the truth. One truth, however, should be evident. Neither our economy nor environment can flourish unless we emphasize quality over quantity. For example, any enterprise can prosper with sufficient governmental subsidy, but subsidized development is parasitic and unsound. The other extreme, we could discourage even quality, sound development through confiscatory taxes, intolerable environmental safeguards, or excessive labor costs, such as exorbitant workman's compensation, or wage demands which discourage business investment, crush even healthy enterprise, or escalate inflation. I urge you to join me in continuing efforts to resist them all. In that regard, anti-development charges leveled against this administration seem curious. In view of our opposition to all three aforementioned growth inhibitors, our opposition to excessive Environmental Protection Agency constraints imposed upon Ketchikan Pulp Company, our support of a reserve tax credit, our veto of an extremely costly workman's compensation bill, our establishment of state budget limits through exercise of more vetoes than all other governors together, and our support of a trans-Alaskan gas pipeline route must confuse those who have been told this administration was determined to suppress even healthy enterprise. Truth is that we will no more stifle healthy growth than we will subsidize that which is unhealthy. Moreover, of course, we could do either only to the point the legislature concurred. Despite those intent of ungarbling that message, it seems slowly to be seeping out. I have little doubt that before this legislature adjourns sine die, most of the electorate will recognize that the cost of doing business in Alaska, not phony charges of intent to do in Alaska business, will determine the rate and health of our development. Obviously, a quality economic base upon which sound development can flourish depends upon cooperation between government, industry, and labor. Based on the hope for such cooperation, last year, Alaska's only brewery began production, and ground was broken for a petroleum refinery in Fairbanks. These new industries, plus expansion of the Collier plant and Native Corporation enterprise, represent the dawn of a new era in which more Alaskans were working and earning higher incomes than in any previous year. In conclusion, let me say I sought and won this office only because it appeared to many that the Alaska they knew and loved could be trampled under special interests more intent upon short-term riches than on long-term wealth. I did not delude myself into believing that my administration could significantly shift this state away from economic, environmental, or social hazards we've been conditioned to accept without an overwhelming mandate from the people. Such is not easily obtained, and that's understandable. Not only are there some who would distort what we're really trying to do, but as well, the public is felt shut out from the decision-making process. Thus, there's an uneasy feeling that government does not know where it's going and when to apply the brakes. What satisfaction I've derived as governor comes most from efforts to reawaken hopes within Alaskans that perhaps what they do and think can make a difference. Tried to stimulate that hope by establishing an open, frank administration, which includes persons neither politically nor philosophically in lockstep with one another. By encouraging the public to become involved through unprecedented public processes in such things as land decisions in the public forum. By adding consumer members to regulatory boards. By insisting that people take their demands regarding fish and game to the board, which showed full concern for the resource paramount. Not just to politicians like myself, whose prime concern could be with re-election. By encouraging people to utilize their own initiative in dealing with such matters in the legislative pay bill, which I chose not to veto in belief that I should help condition voters to understand they can do something about government when it affronts them. These endeavors seem to have kindled speculation that what the individual says, does, just might make a difference after all. Before that unique presumption cools, I would pray that we subordinate our petty conflicts to determination that such spark of hope not be allowed to die. Since we together have only 2 years in which to fan that flame, let's get started.
Is there any further business to come before the joint session? Senator Coletta?
Mr. President,
you've all heard the motion of Senator Coletta. Let me advise the Senate that we will reconvene in 10 minutes in the Senate for a very, very short dated calendar. If there's no objection, the joint session stands adjourned.
Representative Gardner?
I'm going to make a motion to recess, and we're guessing it will be about 30, 45 minutes, but the motion will be to recess till the call of the chair. Move and ask unanimous consent that we recess to the call of the chair.
Representative Gardner moves and asks unanimous consent that this body stand in recess to the call of the chair. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Speaker, were your ruling to be overturned, it would be my intention to make a motion to postpone consideration of that motion to a later time in any case, and at least I would hope there would be sufficient votes for that.
The motion has been withdrawn. At this point in the agenda, I will now entertain nominations for the office of permanent speaker of this body for the 10th legislature. Representative Gardner.
Mr. Speaker Pro Tem, I'd like to place the name of Hugh Malone nomination for speaker of this house. I think all of us that have worked with Hugh and others that know him to be, have those leadership qualities that are necessary to be the Speaker of the House, fairness and honesty. And I think he's going to be a speaker that we can all be proud of, and he will be a good speaker for all of the state of Alaska.
Representative Hugh Malone has been nominated for the office of Speaker of the House of Representatives. Are there further nominations?
Question.
Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll on the question of, shall Representative Hugh Malone be named Speaker of the House of Representatives for the 10th Alaska Legislature?
Byrne?
No.
Bennett?
No.
Bradley?
Yes.
Brown?
Yes.
Buchholz?
Yes.
Carpenter?
Yes.
Chatterton?
Yes.
Cotton?
Yes.
Cooper?
Yes.
Dankworth?
No.
Duncan?
Yes.
Eliason?
Yes.
Freeman?
Yes.
Gardner?
Yes.
Greening?
Yes.
Guy?
Yes.
Haugen?
Yes.
Hayes? Kelly?
No.
Lethine?
Yes.
McKinnon?
Yes.
Malone?
Yes.
Meekins?
Yes.
Miles?
Yes.
Nackack?
Yes.
Osi?
Yes.
Osterbeck?
Yes.
Parr?
Yes.
Phillips?
Yes.
Rode?
Yes.
Rudd?
Yes.
Schaefer?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Specking?
Yes.
Swanson? Urien?
No.
Akers?
Yes.
Mr. Speaker?
Yes. Has every member voted? Does any member wish to change his vote? Madam Clerk, will you read the tally?
33 yeas, 6 nays, 1 absent.
And so Representative Hugh Malone has been elected Speaker of the House of Representatives. The chair, with a great deal of pleasure, the chair relinquishes this seat, although it's a very comfortable seat. And I have the pleasure to appoint Representatives Urien and Parr as a committee to escort the new speaker to the rostrum.
I'd like to appoint a committee to escort Mr. Miller. Mr. Urien and Mr. Parr. The daily order of business this morning. Got our messages from the governor. Are there any further messages from the governor?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. There is a letter from the governor transmitting executive order number 39 establishing a Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. The letter is 2 pages long. It's been duplicated and will be placed on each member's desk. And executive order number 39 will appear as House Supplement number 1.
Okay, the House notes the transmission of executive order number 39. Are there any messages from the Senate?
No, Mr. Speaker.
Any communications?
No, Mr. Speaker.
No reports of standing committees, no reports of special committees, introductions of resolutions, bills. Brings us down the calendar to unfinished business. Mr. Urien?
Under unfinished business, the Mr. Meekins.
Mr. Speaker, have we notified the Senate or whoever is appropriate to notify that we're organized? Or is that appropriate at this time?
I don't think we're completely organized and ready to do business, Mr. Meekins, until after we have our standing committee organized. And that requires the work of a committee to be appointed, the Committee on Committees. Mr. Miller? The House will stand at ease. While the House is not yet completely organized, it is in order to appoint a committee to advise the Senate and to advise the governor that the House is convened and is ready to proceed with its business. Therefore, I'll appoint a committee to advise the Senate that the House is convened and is ready to proceed with its business, consisting of Mr. Cooper and Mr. Dankworth. A committee to advise the governor with Mr. Guy and Mr. Rode. Please advise the governor that the House is convened and is ready to proceed with its business. Next order of business is to appoint our Committee on Committees. I'll appoint this Committee on Committees at this time, consisting of Malone as chairman, Representative Miller, Representative Osterbach, Representative Greening, and Representative Urien. The House will stand at ease until the committees report back. Advised during the recess that the committee that we sent to the Senate reports that there's nobody there. I think we'll find out differently, though, as the session progresses. The committee consisting of Mr. Guy and Mr. Rode is back. Gentlemen. Thank you.
Mr. Speaker, if there's no other business before the House, I'm going to place a motion to adjourn until 10 o'clock tomorrow morning so the Committee on Committees can go to work.
Motion.
We adjourn until 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Motion is placed for adjournment. If there's no objection, House will stand in adjournment until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.